Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Mythgard Academy. This is session number 23 of our discussion of Till We Have Faces. Before we get started tonight, really briefly, just wanted to remind folks that this weekend, in just a couple days, is TexMoot, the next of our regional moots, going to be down in Houston for TexMoot. Really looking forward to seeing my friends from Texas again down there, and that'll be a lot of fun. You can join us, of course, remotely. This moot, as all of our moots, are hybrid experiences, so that you can join with us there. Anyway, that is what is happening this weekend, and then the next one after that, in just a few weeks, 3 weeks from now, we will be preparing for UK Moot, our first moot over in Europe since the pandemic. I'm excited for this. So we're going to be in York, England, and we're going to be having a really fun moot there in the UK for the first time in years. And again, that too, you would be able to join that remotely as well if you're not able to get over there. So those are things that are coming up soon. Now, back Till We Have Faces. We left last time, which in real time was a couple weeks back. So I need to kind of reorient myself a little bit here. We had Orawal's, well, we sort of did the trial the time before, but we're looking at the aftermath of that. And in particular, her reunion with the fox and the fox's kind of commentary on his own teaching. And we ended with the fox taking just about to take Orawal to see the pictures painted on the walls. We are, of course, in the very last chapter here. So anyway, so that's where we're going to pick up again today. Now, let me warn you in advance. There are going to be several times tonight when we're going to jump back and look again at passages that we already talked about earlier on. We're coming tonight to several of the things that I've been like pushing off. Like I've either said like we'll talk about this later, or I've deliberately avoided something in order to come back. It was funny. I was just having an exchange on Twitter earlier this week with somebody who was like, I was puzzled, you know, he was talking about the Golden Rams passage. And he was like, I'm puzzled why you didn't talk about this one thing, which seems so clearly relevant. And I was like, aha, yes, it is. But as it happens, in this very coming week, I will be not only talking about that thing, but talking about why I didn't talk about that thing. Anyway. So yeah. And exactly, Devorah. How could you not revisit earlier passages when you get to this part? Yes. Yeah, no, that's... but anyway, so just wanted to note that we're going to be doing that several times, I think, over the course of tonight. So let's see how we do. All right. This is where we ended. Let's just... this is sort of the end of her discussion with the fox. And this is important in setting up what is coming soon afterwards. I to forgive you, grandfather? No, I must speak. I knew at the time that all those good reasons you gave for staying in Gloam after you were a freeman were only disguises for your love. I knew you stayed only in pity and love for me. I knew you were breaking your heart for the Greek lands. I ought to have sent you away. I lapped up all you gave me like a thirsty animal. Oh, grandfather, Anse, it's right. I've battened on the lives of men. It's true. Isn't it true? Now, notice, by the way, one thing that happens here in the course of her confession to the fox here is a reminder of her being Ungit, right? That image of her being the spider at the center of the web, how, in her case, the loving and the devouring were always one in this sort of horrible way, that everyone that she loved, she devoured. And the way in which she's been confronting that horrible reality just recently over the last few chapters, especially, you know, first, especially with Bardia, you know, also now with the fox. And then, of course, there's still the big unbroached topic, right, of her love for Psyche, which still has not kind of come under her own examination in the same way. Anyway, so again, we're being kind of reminded of the whole she's Ungit thing. It's true, isn't it true? Why, child, it is. I could almost be glad. It gives me something to forgive. But I'm not your judge. We must go to your true judges now. I am to bring you there. My judges? Why, yes, child. The gods have been accused by you. Now's their turn. I cannot hope for mercy. Infinite hopes and fears may both be yours. Be sure that whatever else you get, you will not get justice. Are the gods not just? Oh, no, child. What would become of us? What would become of us if they were? But come and see. Now we're going to come back to this question of the justice of the gods. The fox and Orawal will have a second exchange about justice and the gods very soon. And we will see not only that she comes to have a fuller understanding of what it means that about the gods not being just and about her not getting justice. But we will also see her own perspective on that, her own understanding of that. JJ, exactly. We did just very recently hear Orawal saying, at least that love was pure, right? At least, you know, like the one thing she can still kind of rest on is the fact that she loved Psyche truly, right? Yes, exactly. Okay, let's keep going. He was leading me somewhere, and the light was strengthening as we went. It was a greenish, summery light. In the end, it was sunshine falling through vine leaves. We were in a cool chamber, walls on three sides of us, but on the fourth side only pillars and arches, with a vine growing over them on the outside. Beyond and between the light pillars and the soft leaves, I saw level grass and shining water. "We must wait here till you are sent for," said the fox. "But there is plenty here that's worth studying." Okay, so this little sort of antechamber here, the implication, right, with the walls on three sides and the one open side with just the pillars, is that when we're getting this glimpse out between the pillars, the level grass and the shining water out there, right, that's sort of the direction that she gets the only way out of this room, right? We must wait here till you are sent for, said the fox, right? So when she's sent for, that's the way she's going to go, or the gods are going to come to her from there, right? That's the kind of orientation of the focus where she's going to go. In the meantime, right, she's going to be looking around the chamber, around the three other walls of that room. And I think it's important to remember the way that that is set up, right? We'll have three walls with paintings on, and then there's the fourth wall, which is like the way of the future, the way where comings and goings are going to be. Bricktails asks the wonderful question, is this the house Orawal couldn't see before? I don't see here any very clear indications that it is, like, any, I don't see a, like, what I would call, from a literary perspective, a smoking gun, right? Like a clear sort of quotation or reference. I might have missed one, but I will say, remember, there were a lot of pillars and things, right? Pillars was one of the things that got emphasized in the description of the other house. So it's possible. And I would also emphasize, think of how much time we have spent earlier on in the book thinking about the sort of frontier where the mortal world and the divine world meet, right? This antechamber here, yes, that house itself was destroyed, Ambrosius. Yes, it was. I don't think that necessarily means it can't be here too. That is, it's just, do you see what I mean? I don't think I'm even going to explain that anymore. What does it mean to destroy a spiritual house? Yes, exactly. Think of what that house was, right? That house was Psyche's house, right? She was being welcomed into her house. That house was made for her. It was the house of the god, but it was her house as well. It was their nuptial house. That's what got destroyed, right? That that place. And remember, even the Valley of the Gods on top of the mountain is itself, like, it's still in the mortal world. Like, Orwell could get there. I mean, it was hard, right? And Psyche had to help her, but it's not like she was taken to a completely different place. She wasn't, like, transported into a holy spiritual realm. So there was always, it seems to me, a sense in which that place, that valley, that house, Psyche's house, was not literally or not entirely the divine realm. It was instead this sort of middle zone, that overlap zone, right? That place where the god came to Earth. Psyche's marriage to the god of the mountain was a union of the mortal and the divine, right? It was the bringing together of the mortal and the divine. And that house was where that happened, where she was being transformed, where she was being changed. And remember that implication that perhaps in time Orwell would also be able to be changed, right? So that she could first see it, right? And then stay there, perhaps, and all that sort of thing. So yes, I don't think, in that sense, I don't think that Psyche's house was ever, like, the real house of the god, right? It was a halfway house, right? It was a house that was established for Psyche, right? For that coming together, that place where the mortal and the human were touching, and Psyche was the center of that. So where are we now? Well, now we're in the Deadlands, right? And she's interacting with shades. And when she did interact with shades, she found the shades solid. That is to say, she expected there to be a difference between her body and the fox's body. That's what Odysseus notices in Homer when he goes to the underworld, right? Is that the shades are sort of mindless and insubstantial, and they can't be, you can't interact with them. Because of the gap, because of the difference between the spirits of the dead and the body of the living, right? Which Odysseus still has. The fox, of course, tells her the poets are often wrong, right? But I think it also suggests something different. Remember, remember how vague she is, how uncertain she is about what's happening right now. Is this happening to her in the body or not in the body? She can't tell, right? Is she just having a vision? Is her spirit really here and her body's not? Is her body here? Is it not? Is none of this happening at all? She doesn't know, right? But one of the things I think that, like, the catching of her body by the fox, the fact that she and the fox are both seem to be in this more or less the same state of being, right, suggests that one way or another, whether, again, it's just temporarily in a vision or what, she has, she is in her own spirit, is in the same state as the foxes, right? She is also a sort of shade. So in other words, coming back again to the original question about, is this, you know, Psyche's house that she's in? I think that what we're seeing is the way to the house, the real house, of which Psyche's was only a shadow or an indication. So anyway, that's does that make sense? The important thing there is that when we talk about that interface between the human and the divine that we've seen so many times, that boundary being explored. She's already on the other side of that, right? She's not on the mortal side of the river. And this is where I think it's, Maureen, the point that you just made is so important. Maureen points out that the barrier, the threshold between her and that, you know, place that comes next, or where the gods will come from, or where she will go, or whatever. There's not a river there anymore. It's just the vines and the light pillars and the soft leaves, right? She's on the other side of the river, right? She's crossed it. And remember that, when did that happen? Well, remember, that's a thing that she's been doing progressively in her visions. She came to the river in the river where she was going to drown herself, right? And she couldn't walk into it. And she was going to throw herself in, but she was stopped from throwing herself in the river. Then she does walk across the river in her vision of the golden rams. And she gets to the other side and then is overwhelmed when she gets over there. In the last vision, she was going through the desert, right? Which she was already connecting with the Deadlands. Like she already crossed the river. She's still on the other side of the river, right? Just in a very different part of the land on the other side of the river. And even that transition, having to get up the mountain and remember what she was doing, remember what her task was. She thought she was carrying a bowl. It turned out to be her book, but she thought she was carrying a bowl. It's a roll too, but carrying a bowl in which she was going to scoop up the waters of death. So she was going to the well of death, the well of the waters of death. And when she gets there, remember, she can't cross it. She has no power to. She can't. It's not a river. It's a mountain, right? Like the mountain that the god lives on. And she had to go up the mountain. And she couldn't go up the mountain because it was all covered with snakes and scorpions. And she knew she couldn't make it, right? And then remember what happened. She crowd surfs up there. She is drawn. She is pulled across. And that transition from standing in the desert to being pulled through and ending up in the courtroom, right? That also is like a crossing. That seems to me very importantly parallel to the crossing of the river as well. And now, and ever since she did, she is like a shade. Again, she and the fox are like equal. And now, again, there's no river to cross left. She's already crossed it, right? So I think that that's, I think that that's important. Ambrosius, I agree. I think that this is, and yes, sorry, Leaf, I wanted to emphasize exactly that. She has died before she died. She's not, in fact, dead yet. Spoiler, she is going to wake up, right? So she's not, in fact, dead yet. And so I agree. What she has done, this journey that she has taken over the course of her visions, cumulatively, she has died before she died. Right now, she is dead before she has died. Ambrosius was saying the court she was in was a dark, forbidding cavern. Yes, and one of almost infinite size, right? This chamber is a transition, for it's full of light and plant life and peaceful water nearby. This might be regarded as a good omen, at least as an omen of beauty and goodness associated with the gods. Yes. It's also small. It's also confined. The three walls that surround it it's a very different sort of situation and kind of feel from the huge, dark, almost infinitely large court. Charles says the fact that the book exists is a spoiler in itself. Yes, apparently she is going to wake up long enough to write down what we're reading, right? Yeah, exactly. And it's one of the ways, by the way, in which Lewis's deployment, his exploitation of a first person narrator for this story is masterful. And we've already looked at that. We've already looked at the way in which he has presented Orawal as first person narrator. And the way that the sort of relationship that he has established, not only with Orawal as a character, but with Orawal as narrator with us right throughout the story. And one of the final effects, Charles, just as you mentioned, is that, we know she's not dead yet because she's apparently survived to write the words that we're reading. And that's, you know, we know this book is not just, you know, sometimes a first person narration book will not really pay explicit attention to how the book came to be written, right? Sometimes that won't really happen, right? Like it'll just kind of take that for granted. Sometimes it does become a part of the narrative, right? Sometimes the first person narrator will allude to it, right? Like for instance, one random example that just popped into my mind. Jim Butcher's Dresden Files fantasy novels are written in first person from Harry's point of view. And there are a couple times when he alludes to writing his memoirs, right? So that there is some, like, it's not very specific yet, but there's like a reference to the fact that at some point he's going to write all this stuff down, right? But sometimes a book doesn't really pay much attention to that at all. This book pays a great deal of attention to it, to the point of even like having her book itself appear in the book. Right. Yeah. But anyway. Okay. So I agree with you, Charles. That's a really important, point. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Let's keep going as I stop short here. "We must wait here till you are sent for," said the fox, "but there is plenty here that's worth studying. I now saw that the walls of the place were all painted with stories. We have little skill with painting in gloam, so that it's small praise to say that they seemed wonderful to me. But I think all mortals would have wondered at these." "They begin here," said the fox, taking me by the hand and leading me to part of the wall. For an instant, I was afraid that he was leading me to a mirror as my father had twice done. But before we came near enough to the picture to understand it, the mere beauty of the colored wall put that out of my head." Okay. There's so much that I love about this. I'm going to try not to spend too much time with this, but just a few things here. The walls are painted with stories. Notice that it's not images. Now, presumably what the wall is actually painted with are images, right? But notice how from the very first moment of seeing them, right, of recognizing that this is more than just like some kind of colorful decoration, she recognized them as narrative, not just as like a bunch of images, right? Do the images on the walls move, right? I don't think so, but one could be forgiven for imagining so in the way that she's going to be describing them. But in any case, whether they be still or in motion, and probably still, but just she is so struck by the by the beauty and the wonder of the illustrations, that she immediately perceives that they're narrative. And then they begin here, right? So he leads her to the start of the story so that she can see the story in sequence. And yes, Corey, you're right. I also love how the fox is still focused on learning and teaching. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, I agree. Jackie says, "But there is plenty here that's worth studying," is such a gentle way to draw her attention to the paintings. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It is very gentle. Like, he could say something like, you know, "It would behoove you to check out these illustrations," right? It's a very gentle, like, we must wait here till you're sent for. But there's plenty here that's worth studying. It's an invitation, right? It's an invitation. This coming back to her memory of her father taking her to the mirror. Remember how unwilling she was, how forcibly, how cruelly even she was compelled by her father to come to the mirror and look into it, both in reality and in her vision down in the pillar room beneath the pillar room beneath the pillar room before, right? All of those times she was under compulsion by her father to look and to see. And she recalls that, but even that recollection really sets off the lack of compulsion by the fox, as he is being extremely, extremely gentle here. And oh, you guys are making such good points. Bricktails says it reminds you of... by the way, for those who are watching, especially those who are watching asynchronously, I'm sure there will be lots of... If you know C.S. Lewis, if you know the Chronicles of Narnia and C.S. Lewis's other books, there may be lots of other passages and moments that are being recalled to you here. I just wanted to share with you that although I'm not verbalizing them because I don't want to get sidetracked into explaining other books that we're not discussing, because this is enough to discuss. The students who are here with me live are very frequently recalling other things from Narnia and stuff. So I don't usually talk about them, but Bricktail's comment about Lucy reading the magician's book in the Isle of the Duffelpuds in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I agree. But it's not just the similarity to that moment. It's the similarity to... It's a story. It's a narrative. It's like a book. In fact, the walls are like an unrolled scroll, right? As she goes through the walls, it's like reading. I think that the walls are set up to be like another view of her book. We've already gotten one. She wrote a book, right? And of course, she talks at the beginning of book two about how the process of book one, of writing book one, already drew her attention to the fact that her own, like the memories that she had retained, the memories that she had been rehearsing for decades, actually had deviated from the real past, right? So there's like what really happened, and there's the book, there's what really happened, there's the book that she wrote, and then there was what she had been remembering, right? And none of those things were really quite the same. And of course, we've already had a dramatic reveal, right? Of like the true heart of her book in the book that, you know, the crude, brutal scroll that she was given to read out in court, which is the true heart, which is what her heart had been saying, right, all of that time without her actually saying it, right, or while she thought she was saying other things. So on the one hand, the harsh, kind of horrible book that she read out again and again and again and again until they made her stop is one version of, like, that's one version of looking back at her book from a different angle. All right, when you look at it from one angle, that's what you see. In one sense, the book that she read out during her trial is the reality that underlies the book that she wrote. From another perspective, as we're going to see, I think that the paintings on these three walls are another view, another angle, which if you look from this different angle, this also is the book that she wrote. Or to put it another way, it's a fourth thing, right? There's what happened, like what happened that she knew happened. There's what she, how she wrote how it happened. There's how she reflected on that, right? There's what she held in memory and rehearsed and told herself afterwards. There's what she reflected on after writing the book. This is yet another view, another angle on those same things. Maybe not on the book itself as much as on her life itself, right? Yes, layers on layers on layers, Devorah, absolutely. Yes. And Liz, you're right. It's a deeply human thing that we need to turn our lives into stories to make them into something that makes sense. Yes. And Liz, of course, that's exactly what we've been seeing Orwell doing, right? Telling one sort of different story. Again, it's another way to think about those different things, the different stories that she has been telling us and herself about her life, right? And she's about to get another version, right? Yes. Okay. What was I going to say? I was looking back at... Oh, yeah. Oh, so I want to come back to the parallels with the mirror, because you guys are really... are very right about that. The parallel with the mirror is really important because, as Maureen, I think, had mentioned earlier on, what she's looking at is, in fact, a kind of mirror. And that moment where she's afraid that he's leading her to a mirror as my father had twice done, both of those were scarring experiences. Remember what happened those two times. The first time, her father brings her to the mirror and forces her to stare at her own face and confronts her with her physical ugliness, right? Forces her to admit how ugly she is physically. The second time, he brings her to the mirror in the vision, and she sees her reflection in the mirror is that ungit face from the stone, right? And that's the moment when she realizes how ugly her soul is, right? So the ugliness of her spiritual body, the ugliness of her physical person, of her spiritual person. Those are the two things. So being confronted with the reality of her ugliness, the unmistakable evidence that forces both times, forces her to confront and stop denying the reality of her own ugliness. And I think it's important, and I've been saying this for months, right? This is why I was saying earlier on, I think it's crucial for us to accept the fact that Orwell is in fact ugly. You know, remember we talked about that ages ago, you know, right? It's like, you know, is it possible that she's not really that ugly, but she's just considered ugly? And you know, but no, she's ugly. It's important. It's important that she's ugly. And we're coming here to the payoff on all that. But Curious Chance pointed to this, and I agree. I think this is such a beautiful element of this. Before we came near enough to the picture to understand it, the mere beauty of the colored wall put that out of my head. That is, that fear that she was being led to a mirror as her father had led her. And I completely agree with Curious Chance that there's something just heartbreakingly sad about that. She's like, oh no, I'm being brought to another mirror. And then she's like, no, wait, it's beautiful. Whew, it can't be a mirror then, right? The fact that she perceives beauty reassures her that she's not going to be confronting something about herself. That can't be me then. That must be something else. So at least I shan't be having one of those uncomfortable revelations again, right? That's deeply sad. That's deeply sad. Now, the last thing I want to... But still, this is an important connection that we need to remember. We need to remember those two earlier moments. We've been invited, right? That's an invitation for us to be connecting this scene of Orwell facing the pictures on the wall. So we're being invited to connect that back to her being forced to look in the mirror and confront her ugliness, physical and spiritual, twice. And we're being invited to compare that with her being confronted by her own book, as she was confronted by her own book after she wrote book one, as she was confronted by her book in her trial, right? And now she is confronted by this new story, right? This new story that she is going to, that she's going to see. Now, last thing I want to touch on before we keep going. And this, a couple of you have raised, Jackie was just quoting, the description of the new Ungut painting, Arnhem's, Greek Ungut, the Aphrodite statue that was placed in the House of Ungut. Just to read the quote that Jackie put in, the new image, when at last it came, seemed to us barbarians wonderfully beautiful and lifelike. She was a marvel to all the lands about. Yeah. This reference to the small skill they have with painting and how much how it seemed wonderful to her from her Glomish perspective should definitely remind us of that. And what in turn should that be making us think of? That should be reminding us of the issue of the Ungut stone and the Ungut statue, right? Remember, the beautiful Ungut statue had no power. It had no, it was nothing to it, right? The old peasant lady's not, she never prays to that Ungut, right? That Ungut wouldn't hear her, wouldn't understand her. It's the Ungut stone that understands her. Holy places must be dark places, said the old priest. So we've seen that. And yet now, when we come to it, when we come at least near to what is going to be like the heart of Revelation, right? I mean, this is through those pillars, out in that level grass and shining water that she can see through the pillars and the leaves looks like the land of the gods. The land of the gods itself, right? She's one step away from like confronting the reality of the gods. She's being called, she's waiting to be sent for by the gods themselves. This is the antechamber of the gods here, right? And yet it's not dark, as we were pointing out before. It's not dark, it's not bloody. And when we come to see this place, right? Not the House of Ungut in Glome, but here, it's in fact full of light and beauty. And very, very fresh and transparent, Jackie. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, why? What's going on there? I don't believe that to be a mere inconsistency. And remember, we've seen similar things. Why should your heart not dance? Remember the confrontation with beauty and wonder that Orawa was having as she was riding up the mountain, and she was resisting it because she was determined to be grieving, right? You know, she felt like she couldn't. You know, that was her answer to the question, why should your heart not dance? That the actual presence of the gods is associated with light and beauty is something we've already, it's been suggested earlier in the story, right? And yet, those human worship places, it is still the dark, horrible, blood-stained Ungut stone that gives the peasant woman the sense of connection with Ungut, and not the bright, beautiful thing, which is more like to this. As Jackie points out, there are very, very close echoes between how what is said in the description of that statue and what's said here, right? I mean, I absolutely agree. We're supposed to associate these things together. It seems to me related to, connected to the question. No, not connected to. Another way of looking at the question that Orawal was asking when saying, why don't the gods speak to us directly? Why do they speak in dreams and visions? Why can't they just meet us face to face? she now has an answer to that question. How can they meet us face to face till we have faces, right? The reason the House of Ungud is so dark might not be because of a limitation, because it's an expression of the nature of the gods or the limitation of the gods, but the limitations of the people. And again, notice, remember that scene that we got here in book two, that one scene which was like unlike the other scenes, the scene in the temple, in the House of Ungud, the ceremony. Unlike the other scenes, because almost all of book two has been about the realizations that she'd come to about herself, right? And although that moment was an important setup to her recognition that she is Ungud, and therefore horrible and devouring and all that sort of thing, it was also different in the sense that for that scene, the focus was not on her reflecting on herself. It was about her reflecting on the gods and the worship of the gods and still finding it horrible, the temple prostitutes and everything. I remember how horrible that whole thing was, right? And yet, remember, the other thing that she saw was the thing that mystified her most was that at the same time that she could see this is all really kind of horrible, she also couldn't help but notice that it worked. The old peasant woman really received comfort from the goddess. The people were really, he's born, right? He is born. They were all brought together. Like a thing was really happening there that she couldn't deny. She could perceive the reality of that, even though it seemed really hard for her to understand. Jackie is remembering Psyche making beauty all around her when she was young. Yes. Making even ugly things beautiful. I think that is certainly related to this. One of the things, by the way, that makes the end of this book so hard to talk about, so hard to teach, is that like almost every one of the strands that are being brought together would be like a really good thesis topic on its own. You know, like you could do a whole big thesis topic on any one of them. So like beauty and ugliness, like, you know, the mortal and the divine beauty and ugliness in Till We Have Faces would be a really, really good, like, master's thesis project right there. There's a lot going on there. Anyway, okay. The last thing I wanted to point out. Sorry, I forgot who pointed this out. Remind me, and I'll make sure to credit you. But Maureen, maybe it was you, was pointing out that, of course, when we're talking about her coming to the mirror, like the parallel between her looking at the images and her looking in the mirror, she is in a pillar room. It's a room with pillars. It's not called the pillar room, capital P, capital R, right? But it is, in fact, a pillar room that she is in. That's true. Fanara's Pizza said that too. Yeah, cool. All right, let's keep going. Now we were before it. That is the story on the wall. And I could see the story it told. I saw a woman coming to the riverbank. I mean that by her painted posture, I could see it was a picture of one walking. Notice how Orawal is so unused to lifelike pictures that she feels like she has to explain this, right? That at first. But no sooner had I understood this than it became alive, and the ripples of the water were moving, and the reeds stirred with the water, and the grasses stirred with the breeze, and the woman moved on and came to the river's edge. There she stood and stooped down and seemed to be doing something. I could not at first tell what, with her feet. She was tying her ankles together with her girdle. I looked closer at her. She was not I. She was Psyche. I am too old and have no time to begin to write all over again of her beauty. but nothing less would serve, and no words I have would serve even then to tell you how beautiful she was. It was as though I had never seen her before, or I had forgotten. No, I could never have forgotten her beauty by day or by night for one heartbeat. But all this was a flash of thought, swallowed up at once in my horror of the thing she had come to that river to do. Notice how, again, we're set up to remember her looking in the mirror. The fact that she is looking at a story and she is reminded of the time that she is brought to the mirror to confront a reality of herself, we are all prepared to see a story of her. And it sounds like a story of her for 90% of that first paragraph, right? The woman who stood and stooped, who approached the riverbank and stoops down to do something with her feet. She was tying her ankles together with her girdle. And then she does the double take and looks more closely and realizes this is not a story about her. This is a story about Psyche. And although it isn't a mirror that she's looking into, what she sees is the exact mirroring of her experience and Psyche's. Remember when she was headed to the river, I was reminding us, she also shall be Psyche, according to the god's prophecy, right? And now we see the deeper reality of that, right? We learn that Psyche, if we're to understand this, I mean, if what she's seeing is true, and she herself is going to be confused about this, and we'll come back to that, but if what she's seeing is true, what she is learning now is that Psyche did exactly the same thing. That when she, as an old woman, made her way to the riverside, bound her ankles together with her girdle and hopped to the edge to throw herself in and drown herself, she was replicating exactly what Psyche had already done. She was precisely following in the path of Psyche. She was Psyche. But it's this shock to her. And curious chance, I think of the observation that you made before. The mere beauty, the mere fact that what the thing she was looking at was beautiful in any sense, right, is the thing that kind of perversely reassured her that she wasn't looking at a reflection of her own ugly self, either physical or spiritual ugly self, right? But now we see that relationship to beauty, curious chance, that you are pointing to runs even deeper, right? In place of the figure that she assumes to be herself, right? She was not I, she says. She thought it was herself. She thought it was her own story. She had done that. She recognized it, right? But instead of herself, it's Psyche. In place of the ugly old crone, whose very walking through the city streets she was thinking might give the people nightmares, right? In place of that is the transcendently beautiful Psyche, right? A whole extra lifetime for which would be insufficient to describe her beauty, right? So she realizes it's Psyche. She is struck as always, as if she had never seen it before, by the incredible beauty of Psyche. But then her wonder is swallowed up in her horror of the thing she had come to that river to do. What she herself wanted to do, to stop being Unget, to punish herself for being this devouring thing, to end her career of devouring, to finally put to death the horrible, ugly Unget thing that is her. She sees Psyche, beautiful, loved, gentle, perfect Psyche, in that same position, right? And the horror, and she is stricken by horror at that. And yeah, how long has it been since she last saw Psyche? Decades. And yes, I do not believe that right now, immediately. So one of the questions being asked was, is this causing her to reflect, like, with more horror on what she had tried to do, on her own suicide attempt? And I don't think so, right here. I agree with Devorah that she believes Psyche is much more worthy of life than she is. Her horror is the horror of imagining Psyche, her Psyche. Remember what she would have done to prevent her coming to harm. Remember her pouncing on and beating Redival senseless when Redival slapped her, right? It's her own desire to protect and shield Psyche from harm and from suffering, I think, that leads to her horror here. Does that? Should that? Is that going to reflect on her? Should it invite her to have a different perspective on her own suicide attempt? Yeah, I think it should. I think it may. But I don't think that's not her immediate response here. So notice what is perfectly clear, right? What is emphasized here. The overlap between her and Psyche. The mirror reflection between her and Psyche. We've always seen a kind of mirror reversal between them. The ugly and the beautiful, right? But the ugly and the beautiful in both physically and spiritually, right? Maureen, we're not told the timing. I assume that Psyche did it earlier. Orwell's just done it very recently. Orwell does not give any indication that when she sees Psyche here, Psyche is decades older than she was before, like when she last saw her. That she is seeing a still radiantly beautiful, but now like aged Psyche. Psyche was younger than Orwell, but if Orwell is, you know, even like the age gap between the two of them will have become much less significant by the time that Orwell is the age that she is in, you know, in book two, right? We're not told exactly how old that is unless I'm forgetting it. Does she give her age at any point? I want to say she's 70, but I'm not sure. But in any case, I believe that it is, it's not happening at the same time. I believe this happened earlier. I believe that Psyche and that Orwell's experience came much later than Psyche's experience. I don't think they're synced up exactly, but I also don't think the timing matters very much because there's going to be a lot of messing with that. Does time flow the same way for them, Charles, is a perfectly apt question, which I will say this story does not seem to me to have any interest in answering that question. Which I think is our answer, basically. That we shouldn't bother about that too much. We shouldn't let that distract us, because unless the story tells us about it, we're just kind of spinning our own wheels, I think. But anyway, but again, remember, Psyche and Orwell are having the same experience. And what happens next for Orwell? Remember? "Do not do it! Do not do it!" I cried out madly, as if she could hear me. Nevertheless, she stopped and untied her ankles and went away. She and Psyche were the same. Now, she and the god are the same. She is the one crying out, "Do not do it. Do not do it." And by the way, I do not believe at all that she is consciously quoting the god here. This is, "I cried out madly," right? Her description of this is, is not one of like, "In that moment, I remembered what the god said, and thus I said also," right? No, she's just, this is a completely spontaneous outcry, right? And Psyche stops as if she heard the voice, as Orwell heard the voice. Nevertheless, she stopped and untied her ankles and went away. The fox led me to the next picture, and it too came alive. And there in some dark place, cavern or dungeon, when I looked hard into the murk, I could see that what was moving in it was Psyche. Psyche in rags and iron fetters, sorting out the seeds into their proper heaps. But the strangest thing that I saw in her face, no such anguish as I looked for. She was grave, her brow knitted, as I have seen it knitted over a hard lesson when she was a child, and that look became her so well. What look did not? Yet I thought there was no despair in it. Then, of course, I saw why. Ants were helping her. The floor was black with them. "Grandfather," said I, "did..." "Hush," said the fox, laying his thick old finger, the very feel of that finger again after so many years, on my lips. He led me to the next. Okay, two things. First, we now see, with the ant thing, we can now see what is being depicted on the walls here. What is being depicted on the walls are the trials of Psyche from Apuleius. In the story of Cupid and Psyche, in The Golden Ass, Psyche is assigned several tasks by Aphrodite, the mother of Cupid, right? Her, the god, her lover. And if she can perform the, it's a, you know, we've talked about this a little bit before, but it's, you know, it's a myth which is in that classic shape of like, if you perform these impossible tasks that will probably kill you, then you can have permission to marry my divine child, right? And the first task is to sort out the seeds. So there's a big pile of mixed seeds, and she has to sort out the seeds into separate heaps. And if she makes a mistake of one tiny little seed in the wrong pile, then she fails the task. Exactly, if you reclaim a Silmaril from the Iron Crown, exactly the same sort of myth, exactly. So again, it is Aphrodite who assigns these labors to Psyche, right? That's the first of the tasks. The second of the tasks is to get a flock from the golden rams. The third task is the business about carrying the bowl across the desert to get the waters from the River of Death in order to bring them and bring them back to Aphrodite without stopping or spilling a drop. Those are the tasks in Apuleius. Now, I said earlier on that I was going to both explain this and explain why I didn't talk about Apuleius and why I didn't talk about these tasks before. Because we've seen this stuff before, right? But when we saw it before, we weren't being shown Psyche's tasks. We were shown Orwell's perspective, right? And let's go back to that. She's looking here now and seeing Psyche having to sort the seeds with the ants. But we've seen this before, you remember? We've seen both of these things. Let's go back to both of these. This is Orwell. Flashback. Flashback number one. Orwell on the riverbank. A voice came from beyond the river. Do not do it. Instantly, I had been freezing cold till now. A wave of fire passed over me, even down to my numb feet. It was the voice of a god. Who should know better than I? A god's voice had once shattered my whole life. They are not to be mistaken. It may well be that by trickery of priests, men have sometimes taken a mortal's voice for a god's, but it will not work the other way. No one who hears a god's voice takes it for a mortal's. Lord, who are you? Said I. Do not do it, said the god. You cannot escape Unget by going to the Deadlands, for she is there also. Die before you die. There is no chance after. She has this whole paragraph emphasizing how unmistakably divine is the voice that she hears. But if she is Psyche, whose voice is she hearing? Whose voice does Psyche hear? Psyche hears her. She is the one who shouts to Psyche, do not do it. Do not do it. When she lived through that, she also heard someone who was absolutely not a mortal saying to her, do not do it. Do not do it. Liz says, maybe the fox was not entirely wrong when he talked about the god within. Yeah, maybe the idea that she is of the blood of the gods is a picture of something true, right? It's a crude picture, right? Just like the statue of Unget. Exactly, Yarrow. She is Unget. That was what she was confronted by, that she is Unget. But Unget is the one who is setting the tests for Psyche. She is Unget in the sense of being the devouring one. But her speaking to the story, to the Psyche in the story, which Psyche in the story seems to respond to. Now, again, I think it's deliberately unclear. Am I suggesting that the Psyche in the painting actually hears her? It looks like that. Whether her own outcry is merely designed to parallel it, or whether it really is it, it's not really clear, right? Yeah, Jackie, you're right. Jackie is remembering that when Psyche was a baby, the fox said that her beauty could almost convince him that there was divine blood in their family. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yes, yes. So, Orwell also shall be Psyche, but Orwell is also Unget. This is the voice of a god, that spoke to her, unmistakably, without any possibility of doubt. But she also speaks it to Psyche, and Psyche hears her. Yes, Liz, there is the... I saw people talking before about, you know, yelling at the characters in a movie. It is a little bit like that. But you know what it reminds me of more? It reminds me more of Sebastian crying out to the characters in the Neverending Storybook and them hearing him. That's what it reminds me of even more, right? And I think it's exactly that kind of... blurring of boundaries that is happening here, and the overlays of one thing over another, right? Because if Orawal is Ungit, right? Remember, we already got a glimpse of this. We were given a glimpse of this way back in one of Orawal's darkest moments, when she was staring at the Ungit stone and seeing that horrible Bata-like face, right? The one that she couldn't get away from, which is the reflection that stared back at her in the mirror when she was down in the pillar room below the pillar room below the pillar room, right? The thing which confronted her with the truth of her true ugliness of spirit. That she was unmistakably and inexorably Ungit herself. And yet, the very moment when she was seeing that face in the blood-stained Ungit stone, she was also noticing how the peasant woman received comfort from Ungit. How this woman's life was changed and enriched by Ungit. That is to say, in that same moment that she became convicted of the fact that she was Ungit, she was given reason to see that though, yes, it's true, she did devour people, as the fox said. Yeah, you sure did. Yeah, he confirms it. Yes, you have devoured people with your love. That was pretty bad. But there's good things about being Ungit too, right? It might possibly mean more than just that. Psyche made the ugly things beautiful. Yes, she did, didn't she? Bricktails, you're right. Flashback number two. So back to my writing, and the continual labor of mind to which it put me began to overflow into my sleep. It was a labor of sifting and sorting, separating motive from motive, and both from pretext, and this same sorting went on every night in my dreams, but in a changed fashion. I thought I had before me a huge, hopeless pile of seeds, wheat, barley, poppy, rye, millet, and whatnot, and I must sort them out and make separate piles, each all of one kind. Notice, she is Psyche, again. In her dream, the task has been set upon her to sort out the seeds. Why I must do it, I did not know, but infinite punishment would fall upon me if I rested a moment from my labor, or if, when all was done, a single seed were in the wrong pile. In waking life, a man would know the task impossible. The torment of the dream was that there it could conceivably be done. There was one chance in 10,000 of finishing the labor in time, and one in 100,000 of making no mistake. It was all but certain I should fail and be punished, but not certain. And so to it, searching, peering, picking up each seed between finger and thumb, yet not always finger and thumb. For in some dreams, more madly still, I became a little ant, and the seeds were as big as millstones, and laboring with all my might till my six legs cracked, I carried them to their places, holding them in front of me as ants do, loads bigger than myself. She is Psyche. Like Psyche, she has this impossible task placed upon her. Like she was Psyche, standing on the bank of the river with her feet tied with her girdle. In the riverbank, she is also the voice of the god. Do not do it. Do not do it. Here, she is also the ants. She is the one who has been assigned the task. She is also the eucatastrophic force that comes in and accomplishes the task. A human couldn't do this task. A human would have one chance in 10,000 of finishing and one chance in 100,000 of doing it correctly, doing it without error. But the ants can do it because they're small and strong and persistent. Once again, she is both the psyche. She is both psyche. She is in this position of psyche, confronted with the impossible task. But she also is the one who is delivering psyche from that task. Her experience of this as the ant is horrible. Laboring with all my might till my six legs cracked. Searching, peering, picking up each seed. So to it, right? The labor, the persistence, the pain, right? And but remember Psyche's experience? I saw in her face no such anguish as I looked for. Why is she looking for it? Because she remembers it from her own experience of this exact same task. She experienced anguish when she did this night after night. The strangest thing was that I saw in her face no such anguish as I looked for. She was grave, her brow knitted as I have seen it knitted over a hard lesson when she was a child, yet I thought there was no despair in it. Then, of course, I saw why. Ants were helping her. The floor was black with them. Orawal is all the ants. And as a result, Psyche not only succeeds in performing her task, but it's easy. But it's easy. Because, yes, the ants are willing to help her overcome Ungit's envy. Ungit is envy, is envious of Psyche. That's part of the myth as well. Because you see, in the myth, one of the things that really ticks Aphrodite off, as Greek goddesses are liable to be ticked off, is that Psyche is as beautiful as she is. She feels Psyche to be her rival. Like with earlier in the story, right? Her being worshipped as Istra and getting into big trouble for that. It is for envy that Aphrodite sets her to these impossible tasks, in large part. Okay. Let's keep going forward. Next picture. Here we were back in the pasture of the gods. I saw Psyche creeping, cautious as a cat, along the hedgerow, then standing, her finger at her lip, wondering how she could ever get one curl of their golden wool. This is her second task, right? Get one flock of the golden wool. Yet now again, only more than last time, I marveled at her face. For though she looked puzzled, it was only as if she were puzzled at some game, as she and I had both been puzzled over the game Poobie used to play with her beads. It was even as if she laughed inwardly a little at her own bewilderment. And that, too, I'd seen in her before, when she blundered over her tasks as a child. She was never out of patience with herself, no more than with her teacher. But she did not puzzle long. Notice, by the way, the continual emphasis, and this is really important in this context, the continual emphasis not only of Psyche's physical beauty, but of her spiritual beauty as well. How beautiful her soul is. What a good, a perfectly good person psyche is, as well as what a perfectly beautiful body she has. Right. Okay. But she did not puzzle long, for the rams scented some intruder and turned their tails to Psyche, and all lifted their terrible heads and then lowered them again for battle, and all charged away together to the other end of the meadow, drawing nearer to each other as they came nearer to their enemy, so that an unbroken wave or wall of gold overwhelmed her. Then Psyche laughed and clapped her hands and gathered her bright harvest off the hedge at ease. Here, she is seeing again. Now, this is the first time they're both there, right? The first time it was like, is that Orwell? No, it's Psyche, right? But they're doing exactly the same thing. They're in exactly the parallel situation. The second time, they're initially they're fuzzy, right? Both of them are sitting on the floor confronted with the task of sorting the seeds. But then it blurs, and Orawal is the ants instead of Psyche, or in addition to being Psyche, just as she apparently is the voice of the god as well as being Psyche in the first one, right? Now we have the golden rams scene, the exact same scene, because you'll remember she thought she saw somebody else. Let's do another flashback. Here's the first version. About this time there came, if you call it so, another dream. But it was not like a dream, for I went into my chamber an hour after noon, none of my women being there, and without lying down or even sitting down, walked straight into the vision by merely opening the door. I found myself standing on the bank of a bright and great river, and on the further bank I saw a flock of sheep, I thought. Then I considered them more closely, and I saw that they were all rams, high as horses, mightily horned, and their fleeces such bright gold that I could not look steadily at them. There was deep blue sky above them, and the grass was luminous green like emerald, and there was a pool of very dark shadow, clear-edged, under every tree. The air of that country was sweet as music, kind of like the country out through the pillars, right, and from the room she's in right now. Now those, thought I, are the rams of the gods. If I can steal but one flock off their sides, I shall have beauty. Redival's ringlets were nothing to that wool. And in my vision, I was able to do what I had feared to do at the Shenet, for I went into the cold water up to my knee, up to my belly, up to my neck, and then lost the bottom and swam and found the bottom again and came up out of the river into the pastures of the gods. And I walked forward over that holy turf with a good and glad heart. But all the golden rams came at me. They drew closer to one another as their onrush brought them closer to me, till it was a solid wall of living gold, and with terrible force their curled horns struck me and knocked me flat, and their hoofs trampled me. They were not doing it in anger. They rushed over me in their joy. Perhaps they did not see me. Certainly I was nothing in their minds. I understood it well. They butted and trampled me because their gladness led them on. Then the divine nature wounds and perhaps destroys us merely by being what it is. We call it the wrath of the gods, as if the great cataract in Fars were angry with every fly it sweeps down in its green thunder. Good. Okay. Can somebody do a quick check for me? JJ, could you look in your electronic text, the next paragraph after this? I forgot to include that, and I wish I did. Because I think... Tell me if I'm remembering correctly that in the next paragraph she sees somebody in the distance. I thought she did, but I can't remember now. And I forgot to put it on here because there's already so much on this slide. Yeah, I thought so too. So, JJ, if you could just paste that in for me, I'd appreciate it. The next paragraph after this. Anyway, okay. There we go. Thank you. There it is. Then I saw that there was another mortal woman with me in the field. She did not seem to see me. She was walking slowly, carefully along the hedge which bordered that grassland, scanning it like a gleaner, picking something out of it. Then I saw what? Bright gold hung in flecks upon the thorns. Of course, the rams had left some of their golden wool on them as they raced past. This she was gleaning, handful after handful, a rich harvest. What I had sought in vain by meeting the joyous and terrible brutes, she took at her leisure. She won without effort what utmost effort would not win for me. Thank you. That was the other paragraph I wanted and forgot to include here. Okay. So, in her vision, or in her Orwell's first vision. Again, I didn't talk about the task to get the fleece, because that's not what was important at the time. At the time, this was Orwell's vision. And remember, what was it about? What was it about? Focus with me, folks. I know it's, you guys like to go off on tangents, and that's cool, but focus with me here. What was it about for her? What had she just been thinking about? What was the context of this vision for Orwell when she first got it? Obtaining beauty, Maureen. Yes. This came immediately after she had that realization about ugly people and beautiful people. Right? Her realization that she'd been trying to make her soul beautiful, and that maybe it was as pointless as back as when she'd tried to make her body less ugly by dressing differently or doing her hair differently, right? Yeah. And remember, she was feeling that sheer thought that towered up in front of her like a cliff face, right? Horribly likely to be true. That some people are given gifts of beauty, just as some women are born beautiful and some are born ugly, and it doesn't matter. Like, there's nothing they did, but the men will love the beautiful ones and won't love the ugly ones. And their destiny is sealed by this arbitrary thing that they didn't do anything to deserve or not to deserve, right? And her horrible thought that that might be true spiritually as well, that some people are just born with ugly souls and some are born with beautiful souls, right? And remember that kind of futile wish for another world in which the ugly girls win, right? In which, in which the pretty girls don't win, specifically, right? And then she has her vision. And in her vision, she's trying to make herself beautiful. She thinks, if I can get... So again, she's not conscious of a task here. She's not conscious of a task, of being set a task. She was conscious of that with the seeds and the ants, right? When she was an ant. She had this sense that there was this labor was being placed upon her. Here, she's not. She's just trying to make herself beautiful. And she finds it impossible. The glory and joy of the rams of the gods tramples her when she tries it. When she attempts to invade the divine realm and take some of that beauty for herself, she gets trampled. But her getting trampled allows that other girl to get whole handfuls of golden fleeces, right? Of golden flocks. And the emphasis of that second paragraph that JJ so kindly pasted in over in Discord for me, again, you can hear the relevance to her previous thinking. She's stricken by the unfairness of it, right? That she attempted to get but it was impossible for her to get. She was prevented. The golden rams prevented her from getting it. But in preventing her, they made it possible for this other girl to get it. And that's so unfair, right? She couldn't get any, and here's this other girl without pain, without labor, just just picked it up. She was gleaning handful after handful, a rich harvest. What I had sought in vain by meeting the joyous and terrible brutes, she took at her leisure. She won without effort what utmost effort would not win for me. Right? That's her focus. How unfair this is. That whole experience was like a confirmation of her horrible suspicion, right? Her horrible fear about that terrible thought, right? JJ, you're right. We're not told that the other girl is beautiful, but given the context, I bet she is. Yeah. Turns out she's very beautiful indeed. In fact, she's so beautiful that she's Psyche. So now again, we go back to the Psyche perspective. I saw Psyche creeping, cautious as a cat, along the hedgerow, then standing, her finger at her lip, wondering how she could ever get one curl of their golden wool. How is Psyche going to accomplish the second impossible task? And once again, Orawal is struck by the fact that there's no despair. She's just puzzled. And then there's some intruder. And they turn their tails to Psyche and all lifted their terrible heads and then lowered them again for battle and all charged away together to the other end of the meadow, drawing nearer to each other as they came nearer to their enemy, whom Orwell does not even identify. Right? She is seeing this whole scene. It's not, in this way, it's not like the first one, the riverbank one, right? In the riverbank scene, she immediately recognized it, thought it was her. And it's like, oh, wow, it's Psyche, right? Here, she's seeing the exact same scene, the scene she herself lived out in one of her earlier visions. But she's seeing it completely from the other perspective, so that she doesn't even acknowledge, she doesn't even recognize herself, the enemy, as she characterizes her here, who is being overwhelmed by the unbroken wave or wall of gold. Then Psyche laughed and clapped her hands and gathered her bright harvest off the hedge at ease. Nothing has changed. This is exactly the same story that she lived, but she sees it from this different, completely different perspective. She sees it entirely from Psyche's point of view, Ambrosius, as you say. Is it unfair? Is it unjust? Yep. Still just as unjust as it was before. Does Psyche see Orwell? Judy, it does not seem that she does. I think that's why she only says their enemy there. Because Psyche doesn't know what it is. All she sees is the rams going away. Remember, she's on the other side. The rams are huge. She's on the other side of the rams. And as they're drawing together, you can't see between them. All she knows is there's something over there that those rams are all going for, right? Like, presumably an enemy or something. But it hardly matters. Because what matters is, look, golden flocks all over the place, right? I can gather a bright harvest, and I have painlessly accomplished the task, right? From Psyche's perspective, that's her experience. Remember, these trials are the dreadful labors of Psyche. This is her torment sent her by the gods. This is how Unget / Aphrodite is punishing Psyche for what she did. Both for the revelation of the god, right? For the lamp situation. But that itself just brings things to light. It's not like, because you brought a lamp into the room, now I'm punishing you. It's because you brought a lamp into the room, now you've exposed the whole thing. And now mom's going to punish you, right? Now Unget's coming for you. Now Unget's envy is unleashed. And she's going to punish Psyche. Now Psyche shall go wandering all her days. Right? You also shall be Psyche. And yet now when she's seeing the labors of Psyche, Psyche didn't actually have a bad time, right? Oh, Charles, that's just wonderful. Charles says, how many times have we benefited like Psyche has here at the labor of someone else without even realizing it or appreciating it? And I think Orawal has been on the other side as well, benefiting at the expense of others. Yes. Has she been Unget? Battening on the lives of men? Well, yes. But of course, she's also, as Ansett said, been very blessed in her counselors, in her ministers, right? Her own life has been... Yes, many people have given... Did Bardia get sucked dry? Did the fox get sucked dry? Yes. But they also were giving them... There's another side to that, right? If we had their stories up here, we might see a different perspective like this too. It's true for Orawal to realize that her love was a devouring love, for her to acknowledge in herself that she did take and take and take from them. But that doesn't change the fact that they gave to her. Devorah, exactly as you said. Devorah said, did she take everything they had or did they give it? Both. Yes. It's both is true. Does the fox grudge it? Again, he doesn't disagree. He doesn't say she's wrong when she confesses to, you know, taking everything from him. Selfishly. He acknowledges that it's true. But he gave it as well, in love. Because, Liz, exactly, the loving and the devouring are one. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yes. Maureen says, I am in so much awe of how Lewis integrated his whole life's work into this novel. You are absolutely correct. I do rather think that if we had no works of C.S. Lewis other than Till We Have Faces, we could like reconstruct the rest almost from this book. Yes, yes, I agree. Yeah, yeah. Third task, Psyche's third task, again, in the myth of Cupid and Psyche from Apuleius. In the next picture, I saw both Psyche and myself, but I was only a shadow. So now here she's seeing the two of them like juxtaposed on each other. She sees, so we toiled together over those burning sands, she with her empty bowl, I with the book full of my poison. So she's carrying her book, which she thought was a bowl. Again, there too, she thought that she had the task to bring the bowl in and get the waters of life, you know, the water of death and stuff. And she, and then she finds that she doesn't have the bowl. She has the book. So once again, like in the first one, she is aware at the time that she like has this task, that she's supposed to do this thing. Yeah, Bricktails, that's so interesting. Is she a shadow as in a ghost, or is she a shadow as in, like, is she the shadow that's cast by Psyche? Remember, the sun was right overhead where it doesn't cast a shadow, right? Except she is a shadow in the place with no shadows, right? Yeah. Anyway, okay. We toiled together over those burning sands, she with her empty bowl, I with the book full of my poison. She did not see me. And though her face was pale with heat and her lips cracked with thirst, she was no more pitiable than when I have seen her often, pale with heat and thirsty, come back with the fox and me from a summer day's ramble on the old hills. She was merry and in good heart. I believe from the way her lips moved, she was singing. When she came to the foot of the precipices, I vanished away. Of course she did. She's crowd surfing right now into the courtroom, right? But the eagle came to her and took her bowl, and brought it back to her brimful of the water of death. Remember, what did the eagle say to Orwell? Did I put that in? Nah, I didn't. You remember what the eagle said when the eagle, when it was Orwell in the desert? Yes, you are not the one I was sent to help. The eagle comes down and is like, oh, you're the wrong one. And tells her she's got to go. Yes, you are not the one I was sent to help, says the eagle. Psyche was the one who was sent to help. And of course, that's how the myth goes. An eagle comes and bears her up. And, you know, that's how she, once again, she accomplishes the third task. But she accomplishes the third task once again with unexpected and unpredictable, catastrophic help. Right. Yes, Maureen, you see the tight parallel here? A bowl brimful of the water of death paralleled to her book full of poison. Poison is kind of like water of death also, isn't it? Right? And what was the result of that? Hang on to that. We're still not quite at the point where that's going to fully pay off yet, but it's close. Right? Her bitterness is poison. Absolutely. Absolutely. The bowl of the water of death, her book full of poison. Hang on to that. It's coming. It's still coming. By the way, this is another one of the things that I feel more and more strongly every time I read this book. This is a book whose ending, like, you feel it approaching. It's like I can hear its footsteps coming. You can feel everything coming together. It's not all together yet, but you can feel it's almost there, and you know it's going to happen, even when you don't see it all yet. Yes. Jocelyn, you are right. It can be bitter to watch things come effortlessly to others that one struggles for, even if it is someone one loves and wishes the best for. Still, it's bitter and takes a very generous heart not to resent it. Yes, and remember, Jocelyn, that Orwell was starting from that place of bitterness back in the Rams of the Gods scene, right? That was the whole context of her vision, was that sense of bitterness, of seeing these blessings be given to others that were not given to herself, right? Just as she's now seeing the things that she had to labor for, that she suffered for. She had to be the ant, and the hours and hours of unrelenting labor to sift the seeds. She was the one who drew the rams of the gods. She was the enemy, right, whom they overwhelmed. Notice, by the way, didn't feel like enemy. Jackie, I think you said this before. It called her an enemy. Psyche, like, assumes or suspects or thinks it's an enemy, right? But she's not. But Psyche can't see what's on the other side either. She doesn't know it's Orwell, and she doesn't know the experience that Orwell is. Orwell can see. She's not being treated like an enemy. It's their joy, right, that is leading them to trample her. Yes, yes, Fanaro, and yes, we should remember her bitterness, what she was reading out of her book. The poison in her book was her bitterness and envy about Psyche, that chit of a girl, being the one elevated to be a goddess. Her envy, her jealousy of Psyche. Yes, yes. Because, you know, she is Ungut, right? Who was motivated by jealousy of Psyche. Child. Sorry, I missed the last sentence. We had now traveled round two of the three walls, and the third remained. Child, said the fox, have you understood? But are these pictures true? All here is true. But how could she? Did she really do such things and go to such places and not? Grandfather, she was all but unscathed. She was almost happy. Another bore nearly all the anguish. I? Is it possible? That was one of the true things I used to say to you. Don't you remember? We are all limbs and parts of one whole, hence of each other. Men and gods flow in and out and mingle. Oh, I give thanks. I bless the gods. Then it was really I who bore the anguish, but she achieved the tasks. Would you rather have had justice? Would you mock me, grandfather? Justice? Oh, I've been a queen, and I know the people's cry for justice must be heard. But not my cry. A Bata's muttering, a Redival's whining. Why can't I? Why should she? It's not fair. And over, pah. Over and over, like her reading of her book, right? Last flashback. This is on her way down the mountain after that last horrible time. But I thought it most likely those words, "You also shall be Psyche," meant that if she went into exile and wandering, I must do the same. And this, I had thought before, might very easily come about if the men of Gloam had no will to be ruled by a woman. But the god had been wide of the mark. So then they don't know all things? If he thought he could grieve me most by making my punishment the same as Psyche's. If I could have borne hers as well as my own. But next best was to share. And with this I felt a sort of hard and cheerless strength rising in me. I would make a good beggar woman. I was ugly, and Bardia had taught me how to fight. If I could have borne hers as well as my own, but next best was to share. She seeks it. She asks for it. She wishes she could bear Psyche's punishment as well as her own. And then she's mystified when instead of being punished, everything starts working out and she becomes queen and everything else. Right? Yes, at that point it was in, there was pride here. Yes, but also, Jocelyn, I'm thinking about the comment that you just made, right? We see her reaction, right? Going back to the end here, back to book two. She now sees the reality. She had felt, as we were seeing in the lead up to the Rams of the Gods vision, about the injustice of things, right? Some people given good gifts and some people given bad gifts. Some made beautiful, some made ugly. Nothing they can do about it. Their destiny sealed by these arbitrary gifts, right? And that's not fair. It's not fair that some should suffer and others not, right? And Jocelyn, you're right that it is very embittering to be on that side of that, right? To watch someone receive a blessing that you were denied, someone to accomplish something easily that you can't do, you can't manage however you try, right? And yet we see when it's revealed to her, when she finally perceives the truth of the situation, that she got her wish, that she did bear Psyche's suffering, such that Psyche scarcely suffered throughout her trials, because Orawal did all of the suffering for her, instead of bitterness, instead of poison, instead of jealousy, she gives thanks. She blesses the gods. She now sees her own, her whole life differently. Now even the being born ugly thing feels different. There's a lot more that could be said here, but let's stop there. It's time. I don't know exactly how many more sessions we have, probably at least a couple, but we're getting there. We're getting close now. We will look at the end of Psyche's final trial next time. And of course, you'll notice that it goes beyond the parallels. She had the riverbank moment of despair. She had the first trial with the seeds. She had the second trial with the fleece. She had the third trial with the desert and the bowl for the water of death. And Orawal was with her all the way along, even like quasi superimposed in that last one, right? Which provides almost as much contrast as it did comparison between those two. But now Psyche is going to continue on doing the last stage of the test that Orawal did not herself do. We'll look at that next time. All right. Thanks, everybody. I will be here next week, so that'll be good. I will see you guys then. Have a good week. Hope to see some of you in Texas. If not, maybe another time soon. And we'll be back next week. Thanks, everybody. Bye now.